Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This time of year, the politicking doesn't stop. The candidates for governor have been out on the town meeting the people and looking for votes. Democratic incumbent Deval Patrick showed up at a Quincy pub on Friday. Republican Charlie Baker had Senator Scott Brown by his side on Saturday. And Tim Cahill, even though his running mate jumped ship last week, hit the weekend campaign trail too. Here to discuss the latest political news in the race to November is our team of political analysts. Our Republican analyst is Eric Dahlberg, a selectman from Chelmsford. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Eric.
Thank you.
And our Democratic analyst is Susan Tracy, a former state representative. Susan, thanks to you too.
Thanks.
Listeners, we'll be taking calls during this segment, and we want to know how you're feeling about the governor's race. Are you more or less likely to vote for Cahill now that he's lost his running mate? Or do you think Cahill was done a long time ago? We're less than a month to Election Day. We want to know if you've made up your mind. Who are you going to vote for? And if you're undecided, tell us what the candidates need to do to win your vote. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan and Eric, let's go right to the ongoing news in the Tim Cahill campaign. So Cahill, of course, is the independent candidate for governor. On Friday, Cahill's running mate, Paul Lascoco, announced he was dropping out of the race and endorsing the Republican Charlie Baker.
It is clear to me that Charlie Baker and Richard Tesei have the best chance of defeating Governor Patrick and taking Massachusetts in a new direction. I cannot and will not let my ego get in the way of doing what's right for Massachusetts. So while this is a tough decision for me today, personally, professionally, it's an easy decision when I put the future of Massachusetts ahead of my own self-interest.
Then, over the weekend, we learned that Lascoco, the running mate, had met secretly with Baker the night before he announced he was abandoning Tim Cahill. That means he joins a growing list of Republicans who've defected from the independent campaign. Eric Dahlberg, were you surprised that Lascoco jumped ship?
I was surprised, but, I mean, let's put this in perspective. It's not a game changer. I mean, this is a two-man race before Lascoco stepped down. This remains a two-man race today. I think the person for whom this has had the greatest impact is Paul Lascoco himself. He's being seen as sleazy, conniving, and a quitter. You know, whether you support Tim Cahill or not, I mean, you're expected to sort of ride these campaigns till the end. So it's surprising.
Susan Tracy?
You know, I agree with Eric. I think Lascoco looks bad. But I also think two other observations. One, at least for me, I'm sympathetic for Cahill. I mean, I feel bad for the guy. I think it rallies you around him a little bit. I think you can't help but feel for him, even if you don't like him. So I think in a funny way, it gives him an odd sort of a boost. I also thought that Baker looked really bad standing with Lascoco. I can't imagine. If anything felt like a backroom deal, it was holding a press conference together. If Baker continued on his way and campaigned and let Lascoco do what he did, it would have felt so much different than actually, now we learn they met together the night before, and then they held a press conference together. It seemed like it just was backroom deal, old boy network, really bad advice, I thought.
Which, of course, is what Cahill has said, basically, that this smells like a backroom deal, I think were his words.
But they gave it a visual, too. I mean, it was the smell had a face to it here.
So you feel that it looked like Charlie Baker standing next to a turncoat, basically.
Well, yeah, and then also he was part of it. I mean, that, you know, to me, if the way you bring yourself up is by tearing people down, it's a pretty sad statement about your candidacy. So I just don't understand why he walked himself into a place where it looked like he was part of a backroom deal. He didn't need to do that. I question the strategy of that.
Cahill's response to this whole thing was sort of something to behold in itself. Here's what Cahill had to say.
Although we've qualified for the ballot together, immediately upon my election, I will expect to see his letter of resignation. As for not having a lieutenant governor, I don't plan to die. And we can save money on that useless job.
So Eric Dahlberg, Cahill has obviously pledged to continue on. He's even put a positive spin on this. You know, why do we need the lieutenant governor? And what do you think? Is this the best he could make of a bad situation?
Yeah, you got to give him credit for you know, taking it standing up, and he himself not backing down. I mean, what are you going to do? This is one of several people to step down from his campaign over the last week or so. I believe his manager resigned last week, a senior strategist resigned last week. So the hits just keep on coming for Tim Cahill, but he seems to be a glutton for punishment.
Susan Tracy just said, you know, you can't help but feel bad for the guy. And there has been talk that maybe there'll be a sort of a sympathy vote, that Tim Cahill could actually come out slightly ahead in this. Do you see that happening, Eric?
No. Like I said, I mean, this is a two-man race. It's been a two-man race for a while. Classic tightening of the race. The independent candidate is dropping away. So I don't think so.
You know, the one thing I would say, sort of just going back to, again, Baker standing with Lascoco the next day, the other miscalculation that I see on the Baker side of the equation is Tim Cahill is sitting on, what, $2 million? So if you're Tim Cahill and you feel betrayed by your lieutenant governor, you feel betrayed by campaign staff who you've paid a couple of $100,000 to, all of whom have abandoned you for the Republican Party, it'll be very interesting to watch what these ads are over the next couple of months. It's sort of like, you know, they always say don't go after people who buy ink by the barrel. I mean, going after Cahill sitting on $2 million over 4 weeks, that's a lot of money to spend in 4 weeks. It'll be interesting to see what he does with it. Eric, another question for you based on something Susan Tracy said, which is that to her it didn't look good to see Cahill's ex-running mate standing next to Charlie Baker. Did you feel that way, that Lascoco was damaged goods and the last thing Charlie Baker wanted was this guy on the podium with him?
I don't think it looked necessarily bad for the Baker campaign. I mean, I think it looked really bad for Lascoco himself. I mean, to be seen, as you said earlier, as a turncoat. I mean, I've had a number of people tell me, oh, you know, he's just gearing up to get a job in a future Baker administration. I think the last thing on earth a future Baker administration would do is offer Paul Lascoco a job. In hindsight, that would look disastrous.
Because it would look like it truly was
right,
a deal.
Right.
Right, which is why they shouldn't have done this together. It just was crazy. Listeners, we're taking calls. We want to know what you think of all these turn of events in the past few days. Tim Cahill's running mate bailing out and announcing he's endorsing Charlie Baker. We want to know who you are thinking of voting for, if this has changed your view. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll also be talking later about Barney Frank's race against Sean Bealot. We're talking a little bit about the 10th District, a little bit about Karen Pulido. Give us a call to talk politics. Again, it's 1-800-423-8255. Eric and Susan, Deval Patrick and Charlie Baker have had very different techniques dealing with Cahill. Baker often clashes with Cahill, particularly in debates. When Charlie's gotten heated, it's been when he's come up against Cahill. Deval Patrick often goes in the opposite direction and compliments Cahill. Eric Dahlberg, if Charlie Baker stays on the attack against Cahill, should Baker be concerned about alienating those Cahill supporters that he wants to win over?
I don't think so. I mean, again, every poll that's been taken since the spring shows Cahill's support fading, eroding. I think Lascoco's departure may accelerate that even further. But, I mean, we're not talking about a big pool of people anymore. So I don't think that should be a concern.
I think it's less about alienating the Cahill people, because you're right. The last poll shows those votes divide evenly. But I worry about it. You know, if I were Baker, I would worry about it more. One, it allows Patrick to just do what he's doing, which is look very gubernatorial, very much above the fray, very focused on issues that matter to people, rather than fighting with a third-party candidate who you're also trying to argue is insignificant and can't win. So I think it just takes a lot of airtime. It doesn't help the public at all, doesn't do anything to make people feel better about the future. You know, kind of a waste of time, and honestly, from a voter's perspective, doesn't do anything for me.
Well, what Charlie Baker seems to be doing as well is putting Cahill and Patrick together. His most recent ads depict a Patrick Cahill administration. It's almost like they were running mates they served together in the same administration. So it's interesting the way he's doing that.
And Susan, do you think, as you said, when Deval Patrick looks very gubernatorial and stays above the fray by not attacking Cahill, is it possible he's playing too nice? Could that come back to hurt him in any way?
Well, I think if you're personally getting attacked, I think you know you have a right to fight. But I don't think it hurts him. I think he just looks very measured, very smart, very focused on issues. You know, honestly, in this tumultuous time, it's a very comforting image for me, at least.
We have a caller from East Boston, and this is Jonathan, who wants to weigh in on Lascoco bailing out. Hi, Jonathan. What did you think about all that turn of events on Friday?
Oh, I just thought it was crazy. It looks like the Republicans were putting Cahill up there to try to draw votes away from Patrick, and all of a sudden I think it's going to backfire on him because now it's everyone switched over to Baker. It just looks horrible.
And then, Susan, Eric, either of you want to comment on that? Do you think, I mean, that sort of seems to be how you viewed it as well.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I felt that, you know, Cahill looks sympathetic to me. It kind of boosts him up. He's sitting on $2 million. It sort of helps shape how he's going to spend that money. And I think Baker looks like he cut a deal with Lascoco.
And Susan, speaking of that money, we also heard over the weekend that Cahill's campaign, which does have a lot of money in the bank, plans to spend $1 million on advertising this week. That's a huge amount of money in a small amount of time.
It's a huge amount of money. That's right.
Eric, what message do you think Cahill needs to get across in his advertising blitz to make that money well spent?
I mean, I think at this point he's looking for a Hail Mary. Anything, you know, anything he can do to get some attention, get some traction during this last month, I think it'd be critical, you know. I can't even imagine what that could be, but he's really got to get creative, I think.
And Susan, of course, Cahill's lagging considerably back in the polls. Do you think there's any scenario in which these ads could really give him the lift he needs to be competitive again, or is this just him running down a campaign account because the money's sitting there? Why not?
Well, it's a funny year, so you never know. The one thing I would say that Cahill does have going for him, and I think I've said this before when we've done the show, he really is the most regular guy of the group. He really, you know, if you read the profiles of each of the candidates, I know there were a couple over the weekend, you know, he's the second of nine kids, grew up in Quincy, I think, you know, three-bedroom house, father was a maintenance guy. I mean, he's the guy who is the most like the average Joe out there. And I think if he could ever catch fire in that sense, that's probably his best opportunity.
We started this hour out talking about the latest news. Actually, later we're going to hear about the latest news in the Mattapan killings. But let me bring that up, too, because, of course, this is this gruesome middle-of-the-night killing, four people dead, including a two-year-old boy, two naked dead bodies in the street. I mean, the kind of thing that Boston really hasn't seen before. Do either of you think that this shooting could end up playing a role in the election?
I think it's going to be pretty far away from now to November. You know, honestly, I think it's much more of something that plays a role in an urban election, and it's also very Boston-centric. You know, it's horrific, and, you know, I think every candidate running for any office should care a lot about it, but I don't see it as a game-changing issue in a gubernatorial race on November 2nd.
I would agree with Susan. I mean, it's one of those things that you just, it shouldn't enter into a campaign at all. I mean, to the extent that it's going to drive the discussion about law enforcement and violence, you know, and that's been talked about on the trail as it is, but that event in and of itself, I don't think will be a game changer.
So we have less than a month away. I'm wondering what the two of you think the candidates need to do to win. Susan, let's start with you. What do you think Patrick needs to do if he's going to really need to pull away with his polling numbers from Baker? They're pretty much neck and neck right now. What does he have to do?
I think he has to, you know, make the people of Massachusetts confident that, A, he's done a good job in the worst economic time that any of us have ever experienced, that there hasn't been, you know, sort of bloodletting at the local level. There haven't been massive teacher layoffs, police, fire, that basic services have been kept steady. He's done a good job at kind of keeping our ship afloat. I saw today's revenue numbers are coming in much higher than expected. Our job numbers are continuing to be on the uptick. I think he's got to say, I've done a great job through very difficult times, and I'm going to continue to do that when it gets better.
So he needs a message that says things may not be great, but they could be worse if I hadn't been here leaving the state.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say they could, you know, may not be great, but I think he's got to say in a really horrific time, I did a very good job, and, you know, you can trust me.
And Eric Dahlberg, what does Charlie Baker need to do to try to close the very tight race he has now with Deval Patrick?
I think he's got to do a better job of showing his personal side. I mean, the latest Globe poll to come out on this race shows that while he's pulling ahead in terms of likely voters, there remains this personality gap that people don't feel like they know him. They don't relate to him that well. So I think he's got to, I mean, I would say do an ad where you look at the camera, do a TV ad where you actually look at the camera and talk to the voters directly. Believe it or not, I have listened to WRKO before. I was listening to WRKO last week, and somebody called in and said, he seems like the type of guy who has tassels on his loafers. And I think that's, you don't want tassels on your loafers at this stage in the election. So
no,
he's got to relate.
I don't even want loafers, I don't think.
Now, he did have a meeting at some sort of women's group last week where he sort of just, and apparently this is because polls show that Deval is most likable, particularly among women. Do you think doing that kind of event is going to take care of that image problem?
I think, yeah, absolutely, with the people who attend and the people who read the press on it. But I think to really hit voters statewide, he's got to do a TV ad where he looks at the camera. That would be my suggestion.
Because I think his most recent ad is more him shots of him out and about at a fair, at a fast food restaurant. It's not the talk to the camera kind of thing
right.
You're talking about. So we just talked about Cahill having a lot of money he plans to spend. Let's talk about someone who's been raising a relatively large amount of money, and that's Congressman Barney Frank's Republican opponent, Sean Bilott. He raised about $400,000 last month. That's a good chunk of money for a 35-year-old from Brookline with not a lot of political experience. It's far from what Barney Frank has in his war chest, but presumably Bilott hopes he can use that money to help elevate his race to a national level. Eric Dahlberg, does Bilott's money raising make this a race to watch, or inevitably is the race to watch more going to be Jeff Perry taking on Bill Keating in the 10th congressional race?
I think this is absolutely a race to watch. I mean, Sean's doing an amazing job. He's starting to get national exposure. I mean, every time I go on Facebook or Twitter or anywhere online, he's all over the place. You know, Barney Frank is a polarizing figure nationally. He's parodied somewhat regularly on Saturday Night Live, which is pretty unique for a member of Congress. He's blamed rightly or wrongly for the whole Fannie Freddie fiasco. So when people elsewhere in the country see that there's this bright, articulate young guy running against Barney Frank, they may be willing to open up their wallets. I'd be interested to see how much of that money he raised out of district and out of state.
Yeah. Susan? Exactly. I completely agree. Yes, it's a lot of money. I think it's telling that when asked how much of it came from out of district, he wouldn't answer it. I do agree that, you know, this is a race that he's trying to get national attention for. You know, but the bottom line is the people of the 4th Congressional District are the people going to the polls on November 2nd. So you can, you know, make, Barney Frank, a punching bag and get people all around the country excited about hurting him. But ultimately, the people of the district like Barney Frank. He's done great things for New Bedford and parts of his district, you know, from Brookline and Newton to New Bedford. It's a very diverse district, you know. It's going to be hard to find a rationale to get rid of a guy who's done a good job.
So it sounds like you think that even though people might be feeling excited about this new young guy, that ultimately Barney Frank is going to be a hard guy to beat.
Right, because the money that's pouring in from around the country for people who are, you know, quite frankly, right-wing conservatives are not the people who are going to go to the polls on November 2nd in the 4th Congressional District and cast a vote.
I also want to bring up the Republican candidate for state treasurer. This is Karen Pulido. She had been holding up a $400 million spending bill in the state house, much of that being federal aid. This sort of amazing thing happened today where Pulido got stuck in traffic. She missed a House vote at an informal legislative session, and while she was absent, the measure passed. Now, Susan Tracy, you're a former state representative. You have experienced, presumably, these informal legislative sessions. This seems so odd that just a few people present could pass a bill and one person missing could result in it being passed. One person going against something could make it held up.
Well, remember, it's an informal session. The power that the 160 legislators and 40 senators have is their ability to stop things. That's your greatest power. It makes everybody equal, no matter if you're in leadership or if you're rank and file. The most telling thing about what happened to me today, in my opinion, is that of the 159 colleagues that she has in the House of Representatives, that not one of them would go to the chamber for her and put a hold on that bill from going forward. It tells you that her desire to stop this money is purely political, and it is not in the best interest of the Commonwealth.
And that she couldn't even find colleagues to help her out.
She couldn't find one person to call and say, can you go up to the chamber and hold that bill? Any single person could do it, and they could do it as a favor, and it's done. And the fact that no one wants to do that tells you the merit of this activity.
Eric Dahlberg, your take on this?
Well, I can't speculate as to what her true motives were, but I mean...
I can.
Let's be real. I mean, she's a little-known candidate running for statewide office, a down-ticket statewide office. You know, the governor's race is heating up. The congressional races are heating up. She's got to get attention. She got exactly what she wanted. She got headlines. I mean, we're talking about her right now, so you got to give her credit for that.
I agree, yeah.
Is it the kind of headline she wants? I mean, even though it ended with... it didn't sort of end the way she had hoped, but you think that this being a holdout was advantageous, at least for a while.
Well, in my view, she's presented herself as a fiscal watchdog staging essentially Custer's last stand in the state house. And for a few days, at least, she succeeded in doing that. And again, got extensive press coverage.
The voters will decide whether they think it's a stunt or not. But I agree. She does get attention for it. And we are talking about it. So,
Eric Dahlberg and Susan Tracy, thanks to both of you for coming in. Eric and Susan were our political panelists this week. Eric is a selectman from Chelmsford and a former candidate for state Senate. And Susan is a former state representative.